this evening we turn our attention towards Chag HaPesach. We'll have two sessions of Mirtz Hashem leading up to the Chag. Before we begin, just to mention, Baruch Hashem, the Haggadah has been reprinted. Anyone who's interested, I'd be happy to make a copy available. So we'll start with a Dvar Halacha, which relates, of course, to everyone's Seder experience. And that is the concept of Shmiras HaMatzos, what we call a Shmura Matzah. The basis of the idea of Matzah Shmura is in the Torah itself. But the Torah says, in Parshas Bo, Ushamartem es HaMatzos, there is a specific injunction, an instruction, to guard the Matzos. And of course, on a basic level, that means that a special vigilance, active vigilance, needs to be exercised to ensure that there's no concern of chametz, not from without and not from within. And that is the basic level. But as we will see, and as we know, there is another level, another element to the concept of Shmiras HaMatzos, which will lead to a most interesting and well-known discussion. The background to this second element is the Mishnah in the second perek of Maseches Pesachim, perek Kol Sha'ah, which discusses an interesting question, which I don't know if we would have this question, because in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, there are breads that are matzah, that is to say, entirely chametz-free, which have nothing to do with Pesach, because many individuals who bring a korban will accompany them with a mincha, a flower offering. And as we saw just a couple of weeks ago, in the beginning of Vayikra, almost every mincha, almost every flower offering is matzah. That is to say, it is not allowed to be chametz. From a certain point of view, it was Pesach conditions all year round in the Beis HaMikdash. And the Mishnah, therefore, discusses a question of someone who, let's say, he was a Nazir, and he brought his korbanos, and with the accompanying matzos, and he overbaked, and he has spare, the matzos left over. So that's a windfall for him. I don't know what matzos used to cost, but he has matzos available. The question is that 100% chametz free, is it acceptable to use them for Seder night? And the answer, says the Mishnah, is no. If he baked them specifically with his korbanos in mind, they're not acceptable for Seder night because they were not guarded with Seder night in mind. And this teaches us that another aspect of Shemira, of Shemiras HaMatzos, is not only to be technically, to be sure that there's no question of chametz, but it's an issue of intention. They need to be baked lishma, that is to say, l'shem mitzvahs Pesach. In this respect, baking matzahs now becomes like offering a korban. The procedures need to be done with the korban in mind. Or writing a Sefer Torah. If a person writes a Sefer Torah for practice, all the words are there. The Sefer Torah is not kosher because it wasn't written l'shem mitzvahs, writing a Sefer Torah. So too with regards to matzahs. And it is for this reason that the Shulchan Aruch in Siman Taf Samach rules that there are certain individuals who are not able to, or not qualified to bake matzahs. Children under bar mitzvah, for example, they're lacking the awareness that the halacha calls da'as, that is to say that their intention is weighty enough. It doesn't mean that they're not smart. It doesn't mean that they're not knowledgeable. Young children can know a great deal, and they can know all the halachas of baking matzah. But nonetheless, the intention called lishma needs a certain weight that comes with maturity. And therefore a child, for example, would be ineligible to bake matzahs for Seder night. As we can appreciate, and important to mention, this is only an issue for Seder night itself. Because, as we've mentioned in the past, and we know, although we don't eat chametz, the all of Pesach, But the obligation to eat matzah, the mitzvah per se, is only on Seder night. We only make the bracha, asher kedushanu b'sasav tzivanu, al achilas matzah on Seder night. Which means this concern that the matzahs, to fulfill one's obligation, need to be baked l'shem mitzvahs matzah, or specifically the matzahs for Seder night. Okay, so these then are the two elements of shmira. Shmira from chametz, which one could almost call a negative shmira, guarding from harm, and the positive intention that these matzahs should be baked for Seder night. Now the question is, from what stage in the process do we need this shmira? We find in the Gemara, again in Pesachim and Daf Mem, two stages that are discussed. The beginning of the process and the end. That is to say, either from the very beginning, from the time of reaping, already from that stage, one needs to have shmira, the special vigilance. Or perhaps the later stage, it's only when you actually add the water, when you get into the kneading and really start to what we would call baking the matzahs. These are the two times that are mentioned in the Gemara. Either stage one, the reaping, or the final stage, the kneading and onwards. And the conclusion of the Gemara seems to be that ideally it should be from the earlier stage, but if need be, one fulfills the mitzvah from the later stage. Now there is a middle stage, which is not mentioned in the Gemara, but is discussed in the Rosh, and that is from the time of grinding, as if to say. We've spoken about the earliest from the reaping or the latest from the kneading, but when the wheat or whatever species is used of the five for matzah, from the time that it's ground into flour, the Rosh says that's the minhag, to begin to be particular that it should be shemira with all that goes with that from the grinding. But where does the grinding come from? The Gemara never spoke about it. It's later than the reaping, it's not yet actually baking. So certain mefarshim suggest that the entry of this middle stage of the grinding, which is discussed by the Rosh, came to be because they started to use water mills to grind flour, which means that there was an active danger that never really existed before. Where it literally has this ongoing possibility of coming into contact with water, becoming chomet. When you're grinding, it's by a river, it's by a stream, close quarters, and therefore that's where that minha came from, shmira from grinding. So these are the three stages, and all of them are mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, and he grades them. It's very interesting to see each nusach, each stage with its particular term. The Shulchan Aruch in Simen Taf Nun Gimel says, it is good to have shmira from the time of reaping, from the earliest stage. Tov l'shomra. That itself is interesting. The Shulchan Aruch doesn't normally say that things are good. He normally says that they are obligated, exempt, permitted, forbidden. But here he says it's good because from the Gemara we see that this is an added measure. It's the best way. At least, says the Shulchan Aruch, from the time of grinding, stage two. And in the case of absolute emergency, where all flour has been ground already, says the Shulchan Aruch, you can go out to the shuk, and you can buy your flour, and you can start your shmira from there. As if to say, in the case of absolute need, one can go back to the Ikar Hadin, which is the third stage, when the baking begins from the actual time of kneading. This is the ruling of the Shulchan Aruch, and as we say, we see the three tiers of reaping, grinding, and kneading. But this is another example of a situation where you have the halacha and you have the halacha lemaisa. Very often one could be fluent in all the halachic pronouncements, but nonetheless the reality of how things are processed can sometimes impose itself. And here, for example, says the Mishnah Berurah, quoting numerous authorities, although the Shulchan Aruch says that if need be, go out to the shuk and buy some flour and start from there, because that's stage three, says the Mishnah Berurah, you can't do that anymore. And the reason simply is, at least in his time, and I believe it's still the case, certainly as a possibility, is that as part of processing the grain, they would rinse it, or sometimes even soak it, in order to make the shell easier to remove, which means that by the time you've had flour ground, it's probably chametz, because it's come into contact with water just as part of turning it into flour. And therefore, says Mishneh Berurah, notwithstanding the psak of the Shulchan Aruch, that you can go and buy flour, that's with regards to the Shema, because the flour in the time of the Shulchan Aruch wasn't chametz. Ours probably is, says Mishneh Berurah, and therefore clearly one needs to, one cannot avail oneself of that final stage, and indeed, we don't. Now, as we can appreciate, all of this is background to a discussion which began in the 1800s, and from a certain point of view continues until our time, although I'm not sure that any recent new arguments have been, but since there's two sides, the debate continues. And that is machine matzahs. Now, the issues that people had with machine-baked matzahs were twofold. And it's interesting to state at the outset how this discussion developed when the machines developed. And let's begin with the earlier model of a matzah-baking machine. There's roughly two, pre-electricity and post-electricity. And those that took exception to having matzahs made baked by a machine had two reasons. The first is a matter of mitzvah in terms of the way that we have discussed it. Namely, we have established that the matzos need to be baked lishma. That means that when you bake them, it needs to be with intention. If that's the case, then if it's not you that's actually doing the baking process, but rather it's a machine, you put in the materials and then it's the machine, so the machine can do many things, but it cannot have intention lishma. It cannot have a halakhically valid intention. But without that, the matzahs are no good for Seder night. And therefore, the first issue was the lishma issue. A machine cannot bake anything lishma. Secondly, and again, we know that this was when these things first got started, the machines were constructed in a way where it was hard to clean them thoroughly. It was very difficult to get into every nook and cranny and remove all traces of the original baking, which means, or the prior baking, so the dough remains there and it sticks around, it has time to become chametz, and of course, there can be no trace of chametz in the matzah. Certainly, we would not bake in a way that allowed for such a possibility. These then were the two points of opposition. Many of the Hasidic masters, the famous amongst them, the Divrei Chaim, Reb Chaim of Tzanz, but also non-Hasidim, Reb Shlomo Kluger, these were opposed to machine-baked matzahs.
Even if the person puts on the machine, the same shema.
All this and more is yet to come. So, those that defended the kosherness of machine-baked matzahs addressed both issues. With regards to the first issue, and foremost amongst the defendants, was the Shaul Umeshiv, Rabbi Yosef Shaul Natanson of Lvov. And others, of course, there were two camps here. And he explained that as much as it's the machine, shall we say, that's actually doing the kneading and the arranging and so on and so forth, however, it all starts with a person, and therefore the person who gets the whole thing going, he is yet considered to be the force behind the baking, and as long as he initiates everything with intention, lishma, that is considered to carry on and spill over into all the steps that follow, and the matzahs are rated as being baked lishma. That is in response to the principal issue. And with regards to the second issue, that it's very easy for dough to get into the cracks, says the Shaul Umeshiv, that's a reason to be sure to clean them correctly. That's not a reason to disqualify them outright. If it's a concern, so be concerned, but follow it through. and be sure that the machines are all cleaned out thoroughly between each round of baking. So this is the original iteration of the dispute for machine matzahs. Now, machines changed, and the way that we have them now is different than they were originally in two ways. I mean, the principal way is that the machines that were under discussion originally for machine making matzahs were not powered by electricity. They were actually powered by people. They were called a machine because it was somewhat more developed equipment and they did the job. But what kept them going was actually people through cogs and wheels. It was still people who were turning things and moving things in order to keep the machine moving. Because there wasn't just turning on a switch and walking away, and electricity would take care of the rest. But over the course of time, of course, all those machines are no longer used, and now it's all electrically powered. And interestingly, that could affect this discussion in both directions. In one respect, the new machines, powered by electricity, are better. In another respect, one could say worse. How are they better? Because the machines as we have them are much, much easier to clean. I mean, they could literally be cleaned spick and span. They're designed in a way where there's no cracks and there's no room for any traces of chametz. So the practical concern that there could be dough left over from prior baking, which was for many a primary concern with the original machines, is no longer a concern, one could say. On the contrary, there were those who argued, and depending on the time and locale, that machines were cleaner because the cleaning process made it possible to remove more, to be absolutely spick and span in terms of the machine, more so than when people were involved. So from that point of view, machines got better. But from the other point of view, it got worse because whereas one could say that the person who is running the machine, he's really the force behind it, and therefore ultimately he's the baker, and his intention is the one that makes the matzah, that's much easier to say when he actively needs to be providing the force that powers the machine, through turning those wheels, or those levers, or those pulleys, or however it worked. So you could look at it that way then. But here, as soon as he turns the switch on, he walks away, we don't need him anymore, and the whole thing keeps going. There's room to say that that is a significant degree more detached from his koach. Which means there were certain poskim who said that originally machines were problematic, but now they're fine. And there were other poskim who said originally machines were okay, and now they're not okay. And there were people who said they were never okay, and there are those who say that they're still fine. So two became four. And in order to understand how they're still okay, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, again representing many others, explains that even when it comes to electricity, and this becomes obviously a discussion or an aspect of the discussion that we cannot do full justice to within the scope of a shiur like this, but really the question is, how do you view turning on a switch? Whatever happens when you then turn on an electrical switch, what ensues? Is that you? Is that your action? Did you cause it to happen? That's called grama. That's something else. And this has implications and ramifications for many, many areas of halacha, as we can appreciate. But for our purposes, says the Shlomo Zalman Orbach, when you turn on the switch, whatever happens after that, that's all called you, and therefore you turn on the switch, l'shem mitzvahs matzah, and the matzahs are kosher. Now, there is another element to this discussion, which is very, very interesting. And it begins by going back actually to a comment of one of the Rishonim, the Ra'ah, Rabbeinu Aaron Halevi, who was a contemporary of the Rashba and one of the Rebbes of the Ritva. The Ritva actually quotes his Rabbeinu Ha-Ra'ah. And that is, we have put together baking matzahs with a whole other group of mitzvahs that need to be done with lishma. Sefer Torah needs to be written lishma. A korban needs to be brought lishma. Tzitzis need to be made lishma. And we say, and matzah too, as we see from the Gemara, matzah too needs to be made lishma. However, is it so straightforward? After all, if we compare matzah with tzitzis, the pasuk says, v'asu lahem tzitzis. The Torah talks about making the tzitzis, and that needs to be with intention for mitzvah. The Torah never speaks about baking matzahs. The Torah never says, va'afisem es hamatzos. The Torah says, ushamartem es hamatzos. The mitzvah here of shmira is not phrased, or the intention is attached more correctly to the act of guarding, and not so much to the act of baking. Now, if that's true, it seems, says the Ra'ah, and this is endorsed, as we'll see, by the Chasam Sofer hundreds of years later, it seems that it is more correct to say that the requirement for matzahs on Seder night is not so much that they were baked lishma, but that they were guarded lishma. Now, if that's the case, so let us ask a simple question. What if one person's doing the baking and the other person's doing the guarding? Is that acceptable? After all, once again, the Torah doesn't say bake them lishma, it says guard them lishma. So you bake, and I'll guard, and I'll watch. But we see that that's not the case. Because, as we saw from the Shulchan Aruch, a child cannot bake matzahs. But why not? After all, let the child bake, and let an adult supervise. So the child's doing the baking, and the adult, the supervision, is the shmira. The adult can have an intention of lishma, and he's doing the supervising, and it's the supervising that needs to be lishma. So why can a child not bake the matzah with an adult doing the shmira? That's an interesting question. But the answer, says the Minchas Chinuch, is there is a klal gadol, even when it comes to guarding. And that is, when you are entrusted with something to guard it, and you give it to someone else, you are no longer guarding it, effectively. They are. It is literally out of your hands. And in the words of the Gemara, it's a statement in the Gemara in Chagiga and Daf Kaf, Ein Adam Meshamer Masha Biyad Chaveiro. A person cannot effectively guard something that's in the hands of someone else. And therefore, if the child is involved in the dough and he's doing the baking, he's the shomer. You cannot be the shomer. But he's a child. And therefore, he cannot have intention of lishma, not in the baking, and not in the supervising. And that is why we say that a child cannot bake the matzah lishma, because whoever is holding the dough is also guarding it. Even if it only needs guarding lishma, that can't be done by a child. But then the Chasam Sofer, to further, just in a sense, bring everything together, makes a wonderful observation. We've seen two rulings of the Shulchan Aruch. Firstly, the Shulchan Aruch says a child should not bake the matzahs. Secondly, says Shulchan Aruch, the shmira should be from the early stage of reaping. So the Chasam Sofer asks, I have a simple question. If the matzahs need already to be watched from the time of reaping, and that means lishma, and a child is not capable of having an intention lishma, why does the Shulchan Aruch only disqualify a child from actually the baking? It almost sounds like it's okay if he does the grinding or the reaping, but why? They too need to be done lishma, and he's incapable of an intention lishma. Why does the Shulchan Aruch only disqualify a child from stage 3 when lishma is needed already from stage 1? Says Chasam Sofer, the answer is based on the Ra'ah. Because it's not the doing that needs to be lishma, it's the guarding. And the guarding changes nature from those first two stages to the third one. In those first two stages, when one needs to protect it from chametz, where will chametz come from? Where will water come from? You're reaping, you're grinding. Where does water come from? It comes from without. It comes from outside. The only thing you're handling is the grain. There's no water there. You want to make sure that no water comes in. That's from the outside. And therefore, says Chasam Sofer, since it's the guarding that needs to be lishma, it would be acceptable for an adult to stand by and make sure that no water comes close, because the entity that the child is interacting with, there's no water there. He's just grinding and reaping. You are protecting it with water from chametz from without. An adult can do that, and therefore a child is not disqualified, as long as an adult is there. It's only in stage three, where the water's already been added. At this point, chametz comes from within, and the one who's handling the dough is the one who's responsible to see that that it doesn't become chametz. You can't be the shomer if that dough is in a child's hand, and therefore a child is disqualified, because there's no shmira lishma if the shmira itself is from chametz that will come from the dough itself when water's already been added. So these are some of the highlights of that discussion, and what are the implications for our discussion? Says Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, once we've identified that what really needs to be lishma with matzah is the shmira, is the guarding. So if you give it to a child, so then that you're not guarding it. But what if you put it in a machine? In a machine, in a child, anything can happen. But in a machine, it's as long as everything goes well, there's no reason to expect that it shouldn't. That is considered effective guarding, in the same way that if you're given something to look after, and if you hold it in your hand, you're a good guard. And if you put it in a safe, you're also a good guardian. It's not in your hand, but it's in a safe place. The hands of a child are not a safe place, but a machine is a safe place if it's operating well, etc. And therefore, based on this idea, says Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank, even if you say that a machine is not capable of lishma, and even if you say that it's the machine baking and not you, that's not our concern, because you're still watching, and you're a good watchman, because you put it in a safe place called a machine, and you did that lishma, and that's called matzah shmura lishma. So these are some of the main points of this discussion. As we can appreciate, just a follow-up point, so to speak, there is a concept which is discussed by the Rambam of having Shmura Matzah all 7 days. That's what the Rambam refers to it. Except, as we can appreciate, but that doesn't need to be Matzah that's guarded L'Shem Mitzvah, because as we mentioned, the Mitzvah itself is only on the first night. The subtotal of Shmiras HaMatzahs for all 7 days of Pesach is just that there shouldn't be any chametz, extra vigilance from chametz. And therefore, there are some people who may prefer hand matzah for a Seder night because you need the active lishma, which only comes from hand, but they'd be okay with machine shmura because one has exerted vigilance by entrusting it to a machine, and it's free of chametz. And therefore, all the variations are now out. There are those people who will have machine matzah even for Seder night. That's the Masorah from when it started. There are other people who have a Masorah not to have, and some will have some on Seder night, hand on Seder night, machine for the rest of Pesach. And all of that is based on the one's positions with regards to the above discussions. So from a Dvar Halacha, and again, the only nafkimin aside from your position is probably the price, because ironically, the machine matzahs are squared in their shape, but it's the hand matzahs that the price seems to be squared. My personal feeling is that when it comes to matzah, there should be a flat fee regardless. But there we go. Money well spent. So from there, we turn our attention to the Haggadah, and we begin Halach Ma'anya Has Mazel. It kicks off Maggid, and we'll begin there. Now, it's very interesting, one could almost say, to take a bird's-eye look at Halach Ma'anya, because it has three sentences, and they seem to have nothing at all to do with each other. We begin by calling the matzah Lach Ma'anya, whatever that means, poor bread, bread of affliction, that our forefathers ate at Mitzrayim, okay, that's that. So that's a discussion about the introducing the bread. Then we say, anyone who wishes to join us may do so. That's an invitation. And then we say, this year here, next year in Israel, this year slaves, next year free men. I mean, it's like the entire Seder is compacted into three sentences. And how do these sentences flow one from the other? But this question is discussed by Rabbi Azariah Fejo in his classic work, the Bina Le'itim. Rav in Italy in the 1500s. And there's the Sfar and Bina Le'itim, 75 drushas, classics. And the Bina Le'itim says that essentially what Halach Ma'anya is it's all about what's in the middle, the invitation. However, it says Bina Le'itim, there's a way to issue an invitation. After all, you've got to figure someone who's on Seder night and has nowhere to go, and how do they feel about how they're doing? Everyone else, Ish tachas gefno, v'tachas tenoso, everyone's at home, they've got their table is set, and here's a person he doesn't have. And you're inviting him, and that's very nice, but how does one alleviate or dress his feelings of intense discomfort? Again, he needs someone's hospitality on Seder night. Says the Bina Le'itim, Halach Ma'anya is a master way of giving an invitation to a fellow Jew. Because as things as you see it, you have, and he doesn't. And that's it. So how do we begin? We begin by bringing ourselves back to the beginning. Halach Ma'anya, look at the matzah, we say to look at the matzah. I don't know exactly who you were descended from or who I was descended from. We're pretty sure they both ate the same thing. Which means in terms of where we started, it's pretty much the same. We have a common background. I'm currently doing better than you are, but we started the same. And now I invite you, and you may feel still uncomfortable because the tachlis I have and you don't. How can you make a person feel even more at home? You say an amazing thing. This year we're here, and some have a difficult time, some have an easier time. Lashon Abba Ba'arat Yisrael. What do we mean by that? What we're saying is, this year, currently, it's golus, life is difficult, it's a little bit easier for me, I have, you don't feel bad. Next year in Israel. And what does that mean? Next year, we'll have Seder with you. That's what it means. Lashon Abba B'nei Chorin, everyone will have. I'm looking forward to being at your house for Seder next year. That's going to make a person feel at home. It reminds me of the the vort of the Gera Rebbe, where the pasuk talks about the mitzvah of tzedakah, when it tells you how to give. It says, "Al kein anochi mitzavcha lemor patoach tiftach es yadcha." I'm commanding you, saying, "Open your hand." And the Gera Rebbe says that lemor here doesn't just mean saying, which is almost like a roll-on word, but lemor means to say. Part of the mitzvah of tzedakah is to say to the person who currently needs money from you, "Patoach tiftach." There will come a time when you will be giving to others. I'm telling you to say that to him, because that's the full mitzvah of tzedakah. And that remains the nature of giving and receiving. There is a fascinating comment of Rav Kook in his Chidushi Agodas Ein Aya, to the seventh parak of Brachos. The seventh parak of Brachos is about benching. And there's a special bracha that the guest adds, Birkas Areach. And certain benchers have them, others don't. It's in the Gemara. And the nusach of the bracha as it begins is Yehi Ratzon, Shelo Yevosh Balabayis Ba'olam Azeh Velo Yikalem Le'olam Haba. Let the master of the house, that he shouldn't be embarrassed in this world, ashamed in the next world. And then it goes on, V'yitzlach Ba'olam V'lachon Nechosav, he should have atzlacha with all of his endeavors, etc. and so forth. And Rav Kook asks a simple question. It seems to be a rather personal blessing. It's the nature of embarrassment that it's not really comfortable to talk about it, even if what you're saying is the person shouldn't be embarrassed. If you want to spare them embarrassment, don't raise the subject. You should just start with by saying you should be matzliach in your business, and that he's happy to hear. But you open your mouth and you say you should never be embarrassed, and he's like, "I feel I'm embarrassed already. I'm regretting having invited this person. I should never be embarrassed and ashamed, or in this world, or the next world, I don't know what he's heard about me." But so what's the meaning of this most unusual opening for a bracha? So Rav Kook says it's a wonderful bracha because, as we know, One asks, what can the guest give to the Baal HaBayis? He's only receiving. And he gives them a bracha, but in a sense the brachas are assured, because there's midah keneged midah. If a person is kind to others, Hashem will be kind to him. What exactly is this guest, is this needy person, what is he adding? Says Rav Kook, there's one thing he can add, and it's a very beautiful thing for him to say, because the concept of midah keneged midah, just as you did to others, Hashem will do to you. It's the nature of giving that the recipient is embarrassed, and should be, because he shouldn't want to be a receiver. But times being what they are, so as we know, when a person needs to receive kindness, there's a certain measurement element of shame. Well, so if Hashem rewards the person for his kindness in kind to the way that he gave to others, so just as others were embarrassed when they received from him, so he is liable to be embarrassed when Hashem gives to him. Says the poor person, that's my blessing to you. Everything else will be assured. But my blessing is when you receive your reward for the kindness that you do for me, it should be without the embarrassment of the receiver. That's the bracha of the guest to the Baal HaBayis. So these are, one could call them Hilchos sensitivity, in terms of how to be a gracious host and how to put a person at ease, in terms of how to be a gracious guest as well. And that is the Bina Le'itim's explanation of Halach Ma'anya. It is an invitation with a wonderful lead-in and lead-out. I'd like to move now to Manishtana, and I want to quote an explanation from Haggadah that I came across this year, and it's called Kos Yeshuos. And it was written by someone called Rav David Cohen. And he was a Rav in a city called Tatooine. Now, interestingly, a number of people that I've mentioned this to already appear to have heard of Tatooine, which I find quite puzzling, seeing as this was all a long time ago in a city far, far away. But be that as it may, Tatooine is a city in Tunisia. And Rav David Cohen was the Rav there, and his Haggadah is Kos Yeshuos. And he gives an analysis of the Manishtana, which is absolutely out of this world. For as we know, the child, whatever the child is thinking, but there's a set text here, Manishtana Halayla Semikol Halelos, and he begins to enumerate all the different things that occur, the unique aspects of the night, Chametzu Matzah, Maror, Mesubim, and Matbilin. And these are the well-known four questions. I think it's fair to say, if there's a young child saying Manishtana, so the focus is more on the child than the finer points of the questions that he's asking, but certainly in place at some stage to examine the four what are known as the four questions, or one question divided into four. And what are behind, what is the answer to the Manishtana? And why indeed do we have these four differences? The Kos Yeshuos understands that really the question is saying, it was almost exclaiming, it's different in so many ways. As if to say, you wish for something to be distinct about this evening. But why does it have to be distinct in so many ways? We have, it's only Matzah and not Chametz. That should be enough. That's different. That's enough to center the story around. Or we only have Mara and not other Yerukas at a certain point. Or we're Mesubim. Each of these alone would have carried the event. But somehow we bring together four things. Why is this night different in four different ways? And interestingly, the Kos Yeshuos bases his explanation of the Manishtana on a drasha of the Bina Le'itim of Rabbi Azariah Fejo, who we quoted just before. And Azariah Fejo has a major analysis of what we call the four Lashonos of Geula, the four expressions of redemption, or the four aspects of redemption, Vehutseisi, Vitzalti, Vega'alti, Velakachti. And once again, they all seem to be moving in generally the same direction: salvation, redemption, exodus, taking. Why are we saying the same thing in four different ways? But the reality is, says the Bina Le'itim, this is not the same thing in four different ways. These are four separate things. To understand how redemption has four separate elements, we need to begin by seeing how oppression can exist in four different ways. And when you think about it, says the Bina Le'itim, oppression against the Jewish people will take one of four forms. Oppression generally, one could say, firstly, there is financial oppression, which can mean that their property is hefker, or they're being taxed disproportionately, discriminated against, boycotted against. That's financial oppression. That's a form of oppression. Money. Second, says Bina Le'itim, is physical oppression. If a person's their health and their physical well-being is at risk, injury or worse, that's oppression. Third, says Bina Le'itim, oppression of honor, and that's a very interesting form of oppression. But it is very keenly felt. That is to say, to be vilified, to be accused of every wrong, to be portrayed to be evil or worthless or all those things. Right? An aggression against national pride is a form of oppression, even though no one's taking your money and no one's hurting you, but you're being reduced to nothing, rated as nothing. Exactly. And finally, the fourth branch is spiritual oppression. That is to say, either through programmatic or just natural means for the Jewish people to be brought down by their interactions with others. Either spiritual pursuits are declared illegal or perhaps declared obsolete. And other things take their place. Says Rabbi Azariah Fejo, having broadly split these forms of oppression into the four areas, we look at the Jewish people in Mitzrayim and we will see that all four pertain to the Jewish people. And they're all mentioned. On the one hand, with regards to money, it's interesting because there can be a mistranslation here sometimes. The first form of oppression against the Jewish people was in the form of taxation. Because the Pasuk says very early on in Shemos, Vayasimu alav sarei misim lemananosu besivlosam, that he put not taskmasters, tax masters. When it says Vayiven Ari Miskanos Lefaro, it doesn't yet mean that the Jewish people necessarily built those cities with their hands, but it means that they were forced to fund the rebuilding of those cities. That's Sarei Misim. So that's financial. Secondly, physical, of course, needs no elaboration. Vayavidu Mitzrayim is Bneisu al Befarech, right? They broke them with their with that work. And what about covet? says the Bina Le'itim, there's no greater humiliation than to be a nation of slaves. You don't mean anything. You're not worth anything. You don't have your own identity. You don't have your own. You don't have a voice. The very to be an eved means that's how people look at you, and that's how the Jewish people come to look at themselves. And finally, we have the area of covet. Pardon me, the area of nefesh, which is spiritual damage. And as we know, it's stated and expressed in different ways, as much as this was a formative experience for the Jewish people, but they sustained much damage. In the words of the Arizal, they went down to the 49th level of Tumah. In the words of Chazal, they took to idol worship because they were just influenced by the atmosphere around them to a certain degree. Which means that the Jewish people sustained damage and oppression on all four of the four areas. And this, says the Bina Le'itim, is what is behind the four expressions of Geula. Each of them corresponds to a different area of their oppression. The first, says the Pasuk, V'hotzeis yeschem, mitachas sivlos Mitzrayim. I will take you out from the burdens. the word sivlos is mentioned with regards to taxation. That pasuk again, vayosimu alav sarei misim, tax, leman anoso bisivlosam. That burden is the burden of taxation. And the first thing is, you're materially, you'll be rehabilitated. I'll take you out from those burdens. Secondly, what about the work itself? From working for them, with all of the physical hardship that entailed, and risk to life. Thirdly, where how does that fit in? It says, that's the issue of kavod. What's fascinating about the Ga'alti, if you look back in Va'era, is whereas Vahotseisi tells you that Hashem will take you out from Sivlos Mitzrayim, and Vitzalti is from Avodasam, their work. The third one, Ga'alti, doesn't say from what. Instead, it says with what or how. Because it says, Ga'alti Eschem Bizroa Netuya Uvishvatim Gedolim. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with great judgments. But we don't redeemed from what? It doesn't say. It's very interesting that the flow here has been substituted. We no longer have a point of departure, but rather a description of how it will be. It says, Bina le'itim, because what are these shvatim gedolim? And what is this Ravana Tuya? It is the way that Yetzias Mitzrayim was orchestrated. The Egyptians were punished for what they did to the Jewish people. And Zroa Netuya, as a Mefarshim explained, it's a rather difficult phrase to pin down, outstretched arm. What does that mean? Outstretched to where? But the point is it reflects the miraculous nature of Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Zroa is power from high up. The Yad is what contacts, right? But the Zroa is where it comes from. And it's extended, meaning all forces were extended beyond their natural boundaries. All rules of nature were broken and overridden. And things changed into other things. But that becomes the 10 plagues. That's called Zroa Netuya. That's an extended arm. Things are extended beyond the natural boundaries in a supernatural way. And what does this do for anyone? What it does, says Bina Le'itim, is it doesn't get us any further away from Egypt when the time comes. Geography is geography. But it restores the prestige of the Jewish people. After decades and decades of being made to feel worthless, all of a sudden their oppressors receive their just desserts, and the Jewish people are the people over which HaKadosh Baruch Hu is prepared to do all those things and overturn the rules of nature for them. The Jewish people left Egypt biyad ramah, feeling great. That's the geula of their kavod. And finally, with regard to the geula from the spiritual contamination of Egypt and the bad habits and the bad atmosphere, of course, is coming close to Hashem and receiving the Torah. That's the rehabilitation. And that's the fourth expression, velokachti eschem li la'am. That refers to to the giving of the Torah. And so, we have seen the four types of oppression. We've seen that they were all extant in Egypt, and they were all reversed in four different ways with the four expressions of Geula, each one for a different aspect of oppression. Says the Kos Yeshuos, that is why there are four key unusual things that happen on Seder night, which find expression in the four questions of the Manishtana, because each of them marks another aspect of redemption. That's how the fours are all threaded through the Seder night. The first question, on all other nights we eat chametz and matzah, tonight only matzah. Why do we make that change? Says Rav David Cohen, that change refers to the redemption in spiritual terms of the Jewish people. The matzah is referred to by the Zohar as the bread of faith. The matzah itself is a spiritually beneficial food. What's missing? Yeast. What's missing? The fact that it rises. Chazal referred to the Yetzirah as the yeast in the dough. He inflates everything in excess of its natural worth, and that's the beginning of every bad decision and every bad turn. and therefore matzah is considered a spiritually beneficial food, and that's why we focus on it on Seder night, because we moved away from things that were spiritually harmful to things that were spiritually beneficial. That is what's behind the first change corresponding to Geulas HaNefesh. Secondly, the child asks, we normally eat whatever vegetables we want tonight at a certain point, only maror. Why? Well, that corresponds to the bitterness, the bitter experience. That was the physical difficulties in Mitzrayim. We wish to remember that. That's Geulas HaGuf. Next, says the child, another difference. On all other nights, we don't even dip once, maybe not once. Halayla ze shtei pa'amim. What's the difference between once and twice? Says the Kos Yeshuos. What is the dipping all about? These dips are they're appetizers. It's very interesting that the question as to whether you wish to provide an appetizer or more appetizers is directly influenced by whether there is food that can actually answer the appetite that is then opened up by the appetizers. You do not wish to overindulge in appetizers if they can't be then made good on by what's to follow. As if to say, a person who doesn't have that much does not indulge in appetizers. It will just lead to disappointment. He just gets on with eating whatever he has. When do you open up a person's appetite? When there's what to give them. And that reflects material well-being. And therefore, we say we dip twice, and however hungry people are, there's plenty. What is that? That's Geulas HaMamon, the material prosperity and well-being of the Jewish people. And finally, he says, Shebechol HaLeilos, on all other nights, Ben Yoshevim, Ben Mesubim, you upright or leaning, Halayla Zekulonim Mesubim. Why do we do that? The answer is we lean like royalty. With the leaning is a sign of nobility. Who leans? Not a person who's worthless. A person leans when they're in an elevated mood, when they're in an exalted mood, when they're celebrating, and therefore the Mesubim represents you recline like that, enjoy the evening. That's Geulas HaKavod. That's the Jewish people feeling good about themselves on top of the world. And therefore, says the Kos Yeshuos, this is the answer, or this is what's behind the four differences that are identified by the child, which become the four questions of the Manishtana. They ultimately are marking the four aspects of deliverance from four aspects of oppression. And I believe that one may add that this fourfold answer to the fourfold question can be perceived in the words that we respond to. Avodam ayinu. For actually, we say four things. We say we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, and Hashem took us out, Yad Chazaka, a strong hand, Vizrona Tuya, and an outstretched arm. That is a very, very specific way of describing how things were, and then what happened. And why do we discuss it in that way? And of course, there's many perushim, but in light of the Kos Yeshuas, I would like to say that our formula with which we respond to him addresses each of the four changes that he has noted. The first thing we say is, you know what's going on this evening? We were slaves to Paro. And why do we mention we were slaves to Paro? That refers to the Pasuk, because our relationship with Paro is only mentioned when the verse says that we were forced to fund the building of those cities for Paro. We became his funders. Vayiven ari miskanos lefaro. He took over our money. It was for his for the taking. And therefore, that's one aspect of our avdus. Oppression against our money. Slaves to Paro for whatever he wants to use our money for. Secondly, b'Mitzrayim, our experience of slavery was in Mitzrayim at the hands of the Mitzrayim. Vayavidu Mitzrayim es b'nei Yisrael b'farech. That is the physical difficulties, and that's why we mentioned that as well, that we were redeemed from. And then we say, Hashem took us out b'yod chazoka v'zroa netuya. Now we've spoken about zroa netuya, and the meaning here is the same. In the same way that Hashem says, I will redeem you with Zroah Netuyah. So we mentioned Hashem took us out of Zroah Netuyah. That is why we're reclining, because our honor has been redeemed, Zroah Netuyah, all those miracles, everything was extended beyond where it naturally was for the benefit of the Jewish people, to restore their national honor. That's Zroah Netuyah. That's why we lean. And what about Yad Chazakah? The Yad Chazakah, again, we say it so often on Seder night, but it has to be pinned down. Many Mefarshim explain that Yad Chazakah, interestingly, and this is the approach of the Netziv, Aruch HaShulchan and others, is not about what was brought against the Egyptians, per se. It was the pressure that was brought against the Jewish people. And what do we mean by that? Because many among the Jewish people, they didn't want to leave Mitzrayim, because, as we know. And some didn't leave. And that's also called Yad Chazakah. As we know, some of them were killed out during the days of darkness. And later on in the Haggadah, where we say, B'Yad Chazakah Zu HaDever, and the Mefarshim asked, well, why are you attaching the Dever? Why that of the 10? But the Netziv says, it's not Dever as plague number 5 of the 10 plagues. It's the plague against the Jewish people, who under no circumstances were prepared to leave, because they were happy with how, as strange as it sounds, but they're familiar with the Mitzrayim, and what was being offered to them was a life of spiritual expectations that they weren't prepared to take. And that's why it was a moral decision. Yad Chazakah therefore represents the pressure that had to be exerted on the Jewish people to make a decision, to leave what was going on, the familiarity culturally, behaviorally, and all of that, and rise to something greater, to be rehabilitated, to become Hashem's people. That corresponds to V'lakachti Eschem Li La'am, and that is reflected in the eating of the matzah as opposed to the chomet. It's a move towards life without the se'or shebe'isa and all of the bad habits that it engenders. And therefore, I think as an appropriate PS or follow-up to the explanation of the Kosher Shuos for the four questions, each one has been addressed immediately. They can be expanded upon later in the Seder, but they're all in the first sentence of Avodah Mayinu. Four answers for four questions to be continued with Hashem next week.